Chapter 14, Music, by Wesley Morris. The week in September 1963 that Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Denise McNair perished in the bombing of Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, the fourth biggest song in America concerned a euphoria those four little girls were robbed of ever experiencing. Heat Wave by Martha and the Vandellas was a massive hit. Boy loves girl, girl has nervous breakdown. His high blood pressure got a hold on me, Martha sings. Or is this the way love's supposed to be? Do you dance? Do you call a doctor? The song hailed from Hitsville, USA, at 2648 West Grand Boulevard, the modest Detroit headquarters of Motown Records, which might have seemed ill-equipped for and perhaps incongruous with the struggles for civil rights taking place 700 miles to the south. Motown songwriters crafted little romances perched between relief and despair. I got him back in my arms again. Don't want to kiss you, but I need to. I bet you're wondering how I knew about your plans to make me blue. Politics were scarce, as were allusions to the violence and dehumanization that were regular aspects of life for Black Americans. Yet, arriving as it did amid the advent of the American teenager, Motown's ascent was a crucial dimension of Black American PR. These kids ached and yearned and lost their cool just as intensely as the white high schoolers who were helping send them to the top of the pop charts. They had hormones in common and much more. The music was an earthquake, not only because of its enormous, rhythm-driven sound, big drums, horns, tambourines, but because it shook with the insistence that the people who made it ought to be embraced as irreducibly human. After all, it wasn't Black music that Motown's founder and chief architect, Berry Gordy, had envisioned. He wanted what Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk wanted, to make American music. Jazz artists of previous generations had strived for years to redefine the all-purpose American label, only to realize that their Blackness had been made incompatible with Americanness. The white inventors of race understood that in order for them to remain triumphant atop the mountain, somebody else had to stay put at its feet. But we're talking about paradoxes here. Conscripting jazz to the category of Black music just made white people all the hungrier for it. Since it had radiated out from New Orleans around the turn of the century, jazz had been feverishly clamored for, casting a spell that lasted for at least five decades. James Bubber Miley making his trumpet swoon in Ellington's absurdly sensual The Mooch in 1928. Ethel Waters, once one of the highest paid women in entertainment, smiling through the melancholy of Am I Blue in 1929. Fats Waller's Ooze and Attack stride piano 8 years later on The Joint is Jumpin'. Ella Fitzgerald finding herself alongside the drummer and bandleader Chick Webb, perfecting a luscious emotional language whose street name was Scat. Webb's band battling Count Basie's in a live contest at the Savoy Ballroom in 1938, transforming the music's orchestral sound into an Olympics of kinetic innovation. In those years, white Americans' principal hunger was for secondhand Blackness. They packed clubs that steered them to whites-only sections or, as was the policy at the Roseland Ballroom until 1924, clubs that denied Black people entry altogether, as patrons and performers. It was deemed safer that way. In fact, why not have white guys play the music too? In the hands of Black musicians, the white presumption went, swing was too sexy, too primitive to be suitable for the droves who stuffed dance halls to Lindy Hop, to Susie Q, to Jitterbug. Jungle music was what white people called Ellington's early work. Before someone like Armstrong could be deemed jazz's epitome, the country needed a non-Black artist to adore. Someone with a name that left little doubt about what was what. That's how Americans wound up with an acute Paul Whiteman obsession. Whiteman, who first played George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, who sold so many millions of records that the white press crowned him the King of Jazz. Not necessarily because he wanted the title, since he played segregated clubs, he was prohibited from hiring Black arrangers and Black players, but because in the late 1920s and early 1930s, a pasteurized jazz suited America's tastes. Pass the culture, hold the people. But as the country approached the 1960s, maybe white Americans were finally ready for the thing itself. Recordings and television broadcasts were putting more black artists in more white people's homes. Regality and religion helped heighten their allure. An innovative singer and songwriter like Sam Cooke imagined a pop music that induced hyperventilating, yet never dared remove its choral robe. It was lush, impassioned, nestled in the palatable harmonies of 1940s and 1950s serenades and doo-wop singing. Neither hot jazz nor fiery sermon, but a dozen roses, a milkshake with two straws. Cook's arrangements were a perfect fusion between the sacred and the secular, between robust blackness and the American songbook's high snuggle era. In the 1950s and early 1960s, Cook embodied black pop singing's seamless transition from wailing choir boy to romantic heat source. Motown went a step further. The chapel became a power station. Gordy oversaw full-scale integration of Western classical orchestral instruments, strings, horns, woodwinds, with the black musical experience. Church on a Sunday morning, rhythm sections, gospel harmonies, hand claps, and juke joint Saturday nights. Rhythm sections, guitars, vigor. Pure, yet busy. What resulted was the Motown sound. A whole daggone weekend in 3 minutes. Motown songs had titles like Do You Love Me? And I Second That Emotion. Ain't Too Proud to Beg. And I Hear a Symphony. They bounced and lilted in defiance of the violence black Americans faced. The heaviness so many of them carried. Those songs and the way the company stars performed them were declarations of war against the insults of the past and the present. The scratchy piccolo at the start of a Four Tops classic was, in its way, an elegant political act. Sorrow as raised fist. The fact that the label specialized in love songs was crucial to its impact. Love was the void at the center of the country. Laws, policies, and codes both stated and implied that black people were unsuitable for loving, that they were unsuitable for life. Now here was music, popular music, American music, that insisted the opposite was true. No one had ever heard anything as religious, yet as rough and impassioned as a song like Heatwave, with those vandelic harmonizing vocals by Rosalind Ashford and Annette Beard, responding to the call of Martha Reeves' urgency. But perhaps the most crucial aspect of Motown, for all that would come after, is that it was a black-owned company that made stars of black people. Gordy founded Motown with the mission of making its artists the most desired and most respected people in the country. He presented his artists with a sense of polish, decorum, and self-possession that would have struck anyone who beheld them on American Bandstand or the Ed Sullivan Show as wholly unlike the servants and fools that it tended to enliven and degrade American entertainment. Motown's brand of propriety stood in contrast to the gale force of someone like Tina Turner. Her haymaker singing and tornadic stage presence helped instill rock and roll with its exhilarating, ferocious instability. But she might have been too overwhelming for a country determined, as Turner would later put it herself, to keep doing things nice and easy. Motown read the room and deployed a different strategy. The company unfurled as glamorous a blackness as this country has ever mass-produced. Black men in formal suits, black women in ball gowns, stables of black writers, producers, and musicians, backup singers solving social equations with geometric choreography. This wasn't the first black-owned recording label. It was, however, the first to assert dominion over white America's ancient ambivalent appetite for blackness. Motown's genius for mechanization ensured that in its wake, other artists could also leave a meteor's dent in the national consciousness. Gordy built an auto plant around black expression that neither wrecked it nor watered it down. His company confirmed what African Americans had always known about black culture, that it was American culture indeed. From that point forward, art that emerged in poverty, from want, in despair, art forged in a moral quarantine, would take its place at the center of everything. Art created by visionaries, innovators, and synthesists who had previously existed on the margins of American wealth and power would become the sun around which the culture orbited. Aretha Franklin, Quincy Jones, Jimmy Heath, Jimmy Smith, B.B. King, James Brown, Etta James, Inez and Charlie Fox, Jimi Hendrix, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Dionne Warwick, Nina Simone, Sly and the Family Stone, Ornette Coleman, Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, Mary Clayton, Pharoah Sanders, Yusef Lateef, Gamble and Huff, The OJs, Maurice White, Philip Bailey, Teddy Pendergrass, Herbie Hancock, Roberta Flack, Alice Coltrane, Minnie Riperton, George Benson, Phoebe Snow, Donnie Hathaway, The Isley Brothers, Funkadelic, Charlie Pride, Patti LaBelle, Chaka Khan, Nona Hendrix, Carl Anderson, Dee Dee Bridgewater, The Fifth Dimension, Betty Davis, Al Green, Nick Ashford, Valerie Simpson, Melba Moore, Nile Rodgers, Larry Levan, Buddy Guy, Lionel Richie, Sylvester, Al Jarreau, Bill Withers, Michael Jackson, David Washington, Cecil Taylor, Natalie Cole, Gwen Guthrie, Donna Summer, Phyllis Hyman, Stanley Clark, Mays featuring Frankie Beverly, Bad Brains, Prince, Grandmaster Flash, Millie Jackson, Sherelle, Patty Austin, Climax, Curtis Blow, Full Force, Shirley Caesar, Luther Vandross, Stephanie Mills, Andre Crouch, Jennifer Holliday, Betty LaVette, Peebo Bryson, Cheryl Lynn, Fishbone, James Ingram, Anita Baker, Rick James, Eric B. and Rakim, LL Cool J, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, Janet Jackson, The Clark Sisters, MC Light, Babyface, Whitney Houston, Wynton Marsalis, KRS-One, Queen Latifah, Salt and Peppa, Bobby McFerrin, Jody Watley, Teddy Riley, Tracy Chapman, Lenny Kravitz, Public Enemy, Robert Cray, N.W.A., En Vogue, Terry Lynn Carrington, Gangstar, Mariah Carey, TLC, Mary J. Blige, Kirk Franklin, RuPaul, Raphael Sadiq, Ann Nesby, Living Color, A Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, D'Angelo, Darius Rucker, Aaliyah, Nas, Goody Mob, Keb Mo, Cassandra Wilson, Outkast, Wu-Tang Clan, The Notorious B.I.G., Thornetta Davis, The Roots, Swizz Beatz, Erykah Badu, Timbaland, Michelle and Andighiacello, Master P, Jay-Z, Pharrell Williams, Lauryn Hill, Snoop Dogg, Tupac Shakur, Kanye West, Sean Combs, Lil' Kim, Missy Elliott, Audra McDonald, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Alice Smith, Jill Scott, Rhiannon Giddens, India Ari, Alicia Keys, Beyonce, Tasha Cobbs Leonard, Janelle Monáe, Jennifer Hudson, Kendrick Lamar, Solange, Santigold, Frank Ocean, John Legend, Keisha Cole, Jason Moran, Kamasi Washington, Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, Anderson Paak, Childish Gambino, Esperanza Spalding, John Batiste, Leslie Odom Jr., David Diggs, Robert Randolph, Gary Clark Jr., Future, Valerie June, Brittany Howard, Saweetie, Megan Thee Stallion, Sedan Archives, Christone Kingfish Ingram, Mickey Guyton, Cecile McLaurin Savant, Bartice Strange, Lil Baby, Gunna, SZA, Lizzo. African Americans make up 13% of the population, yet account for an incalculable amount of what moves us and how we move. The last 20 years of Billboard year-end charts teem with soul music and hip-hop innovations. Black choreography often starts the dance crazes that sweep TikTok's 100 million-plus active American users. The staccato juts and thrusts, the dips, swerves, and pivots, combined with an assortment of gestural herbs and spices, Decades of jams written, produced, and performed by black artists sustain parties in places that sustain no actual black people. This unceasing eruption of ingenuity, invention, intuition, and improvisation constitutes the very core of American culture. And that's in part because white people won't stop putting it there. The stars of Motown were the descendants of enslaved laborers, women and men who made music as they toiled. This was in part to get through the work itself, but also to transcend the culture of the slave condition, the mindset of worthlessness and dispossession. When enslaved Africans arrived in the American colonies, they brought with them traditions of percussive rhythm that could be made on a drum as easily as with the body. The Christianity that defined colonial life had alternative musical priorities, melody being the most substantial. But gradually, the dislocated, reluctantly acculturated Africans made modifications. One of these became known as the ring shout, wherein people would dance and chant in a circle. Rhythm merged with harmony, culminating in survival songs chiefly inspired by the Bible's most salient tales. When enslavers made the Bible available, they often removed all of Exodus, with its stories of divine justice, of the Lord delivering Israel from bondage. The enslaved people who were familiar with those stories, firsthand or otherwise, built them into sermons and incorporated them into songs. Songs intoned in small prayer houses and formal churches. They sang while they worked, achieving conversance in a book many of them were never allowed to become literate enough to read. A book whose allegories some enslavers deemed too resonant for the fertile imaginations of the enslaved. Sometimes the songs were created under duress, demanded by overseers who distrusted the silence of field work, or who, perhaps, couldn't bear the unnatural sounds of enslavement and required a sweetener. A silent slave is not liked by masters or overseers, reported Frederick Douglass in the second of his autobiographies, My Bondage and My Freedom. But the makers of the music found something deeper in it than an obligation to distract or delight. Writing of his enslaved Maryland boyhood and the hymn Bound for the Land of Canaan, Douglass conjured the spiritual's wishful volition. A keen observer might have detected in our repeated singing of O Canaan, Sweet Canaan, I am bound for the land of Canaan, something more than a hope of reaching heaven. We meant to reach the north, and the north was our Canaan. Those work songs pleaded for deliverance and were sung in defiance of atrocity. Spirituals, they were called, and they're this country's original folk music. Songs sung out of the determination by the enslaved to orient themselves toward some higher vocation, and, in Douglass's estimation, toward a more humane land, here or perhaps in a less earthly realm. The singing was done together in groups, and according to the anthropologist and Negro folk laureate Zora Neale Hurston, never the same way twice. Each singing of the piece is a new creation, she wrote. The action in these songs resisted the simple jotting down of musical notation. Nonetheless, after the Civil War and toward the end of the 1800s, attempts were made to reproduce them on paper and have them published. Interpolations of captive people's music commenced at least as soon as 1867 with the publication of Slave Songs of the United States, a collection of 136 songs transcribed and assembled by the white abolitionists Lucy McKim Garrison, Charles Pickard Ware, and William Francis Allen, who didn't always know what they were getting down. A chief agent in the formal arranging of the spiritual was the composer, pianist, and soprano Ella Shepherd, a black woman. Shepherd deeply involved herself in both the preservation of this music and its mindful reproduction in concert venues. She helped direct the Fisk Jubilee Singers, a black student choral ensemble which, along with the Hampton Singers, began to perform these songs, including Shepherd's interpretations. During and after Reconstruction, the Jubilees were dispatched on tours all over the country to raise money for newly established black colleges, singing mostly for white audiences. Their arrangements are the bedrock of the American gospel tradition. The Jubilees' version of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot has been recorded scores of times in countless variations by the likes of Etta James and the Staples Singers on the one hand and Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard on the other. These attempts at documentation of the spirituals were translations, interpretations, advancements, and crucially, proof of survival, and a record of creativity. But the music just wasn't the same, in part perhaps because the harrowing conditions that produced it had been abolished, and in part because the new versions were laced with something Hurston knew the music disliked: fuss. The original spirituals weren't fussed over. Spontaneity was their power source. Its truth dies under training, like flowers under hot water, Hurston surmised. These songs were in a language of slaps, pats, stomps, guttural sounds, of breathing, sounds that defied any ready Anglophone linguistics. Black people weren't creating spirituals for wide appeal either. These songs weren't meant to be consumed. Among all else that spirituals could be, they were essentially communal, a people speaking to each other and reaching for God, together. Their evanescent, evaporative, one-of-a-kind nature seemed to acknowledge the sobering impermanence of the bonds among their singers. Yet to learn a spiritual, no matter how, is to know it forever. Here today, and God willing, here tomorrow too. Among the duties of the enslaved was the enslaver's entertainment. Black people were called upon to fiddle and dance for their white owners and their guests. Musicians were loaned out to other enslavers. Eventually, on their days off, they'd take their instruments into town to play and dance for pennies, sometimes for food. White people took in these songs and dances. They considered it savage, but that alleged wildness turned them on. A white person could deem black musicians lowly, subhuman, beyond redemption, while still finding himself helpless to resist their talent. Alas, some of these white people were so captivated that gawking was no longer enough. Before the Hampton Singers and Jubilee started performing, 19th century black music had never reached the masses through black artists. What the country at large heard was something altogether different. It was the music of black people as performed by white people, a cartoon of the dances they did and the way they spoke. It wasn't black music at all, but blackface minstrelsy. White men painted pitch black, doing dopey, but not unskilled, dances and singing comic songs as they imagined black people might. Until the 1830s, American stages had been fat with imported European culture. Shakespeare, operas, waltzes. What was there for the common man to enjoy? Blackface minstrelsy was it, the birth of American popular culture. Minstrelsy's peak stretched from the 1840s to the 1870s, years when the country was at its most violently and legislatively polarized about slavery. Years that included the ferocious rhetorical ascent of Douglas, John Brown's botched instigation of a black insurrection at Harper's Ferry, the Civil War, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and Reconstruction. What minstrelsy offered the country during this period was an entertainment of talent, ribaldry, and polemics. But it also lent racism a stage upon which existential fear could become jubilation and contempt could become fantasy. The white person most frequently identified as the father of the art form is Thomas Dartmouth Rice, a New Yorker who performed as T.D. Rice, and in acclaim was lusted after as Daddy Rice, the Negro par excellence. Rice was a minstrel, which by the 1930s, when his stardom was at its most refulgent, meant he painted his face with burned cork in grotesque approximation of the enslaved black people he was imitating. In 1828, Rice had been a nobody actor in his early 20s, touring with a theater company in Cincinnati, or Louisville, historians don't know for sure, when one version of the story goes, he saw a decrepit, possibly disfigured old black man singing while grooming a horse on the property of a white man whose last name was Crow. On went the light bulb. Rice took in the tune and the movements, but failed, it seems, to take down the old man's name. So in the song, the horse groomer became who Rice needed him to be. Wheel about and turn about just so, went his tune. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow. And just like that, this white man had invented the character who would become the mascot for two centuries of legalized racism. That night, Rice made himself up to look like the old black man. Or something like him, because for this getup, Rice most likely concocted skin blacker than any actual black person's. He invented a gibberish dialect meant to imply black speech, and he turned the old man's melody and hobbled movements into a song and dance routine that no white audience had ever experienced before. What they saw caused a sensation, The crowd demanded 20 encores. Rice had a hit on his hands. He repeated the act again, night after night, for audiences so profoundly jolted that he was frequently mobbed during performances. Across the Ohio River, a short distance from all that adulation, was Boone County, Kentucky, which was largely populated by enslaved Africans. As they were being worked, sometimes to death, white people, desperate with anticipation, were paying to see a terrible distortion of the enslaved depicted at play. Other white performers came and conquered, particularly the Virginia minstrels, who exploded in 1843, burned brightly, and then after only months, burned out. The circus impresario P.T. Barnum caught the fever, making a habit of booking minstrel troupes for his American Museum. When he was short on performers, he blacked up himself. By the 1840s, minstrel acts were taking over concert halls, doing long residencies at some of the largest theaters in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. A blackface minstrel would sing, dance, play music, give speeches, and cut up for white audiences, almost exclusively in the North, at least initially. Blackface was used for mock operas and political monologues. They called them stump speeches. Skits, gender parodies, and dances. It stars with the 19th century versions of Elvis, the Beatles, NSYNC. It was, on the one hand, harmless fun. Men in silly clothes and garish makeup inventing a kind of sketch comedy variety show. But the audience's prolonged exposure to these images normalized their intended hideousness. White performers jostled with each other to lay claim to being the real thing. The real black thing. Night after night, for six solid decades at least, audience upon audience looked on gleefully, and the false ideas being told about black people took on lives of their own. An art form populated, often entirely by these horrid counterfeits, thrilled the white people who paid to see them do skits about bickering black couples and songs like Uncle Gabriel about a coon hunt. The Virginia minstrels did a version to great acclaim. Sometimes the fourth verse went like this. De niggas, they come all around and kick up a devil of a splutter. They eat de coon and clear de ground to dance de chicken flutter. They dance all night till they broke a day to a tune of de old banjo. And then they all did gwan away before the chicken crow. During minstrelsy's heyday, white songwriters like Stephen Foster composed the tunes the minstrels sang. Tunes we continue to sing more than a century later. Like O Susanna, Dixie, Camp Town Races, Swanee River, and My Old Kentucky Home, Goodnight. Edwin Pierce Christie's group Christie's Minstrels formed a band. Banjo, fiddle, bone castanets, tambourine, whose combination of instruments laid the groundwork for American popular music, from bluegrass to Motown. Some of these instruments had come from Africa. Among the enslaved, the banjo's body would have been a desiccated gourd. In Doodah, his book on Foster's work and life, Kent Emerson writes that the fiddle and banjo were paired for the melody, while the bones chattered and the tambourine thumped and jingled a beat that is still heard round the world. This was the root of the American rock band. The first wave of minstrels had never meaningfully been South. In their shows, the tunes they played were based on Irish melodies and used Western choral harmonies, not the proto-gospel call-and-response spirituals that were the real thing. They tethered black people and black life to white musical structures, like, say, the polka. The mix that would define the young nation was already well underway. Europe, plus slavery, plus the circus, times harmony, comedy, and drama, equals Americana. And the muses for their songs were people they had seldom ever encountered, whose enslavement they rarely opposed and instead sentimentalized. Foster's beloved minstrel show staple, Old Uncle Ned, for instance, warmly, if disrespectfully, eulogizes the enslaved the way you might a salaried worker or an actual uncle. Then lay down the shovel and the hoe, hang up the fiddle and the bow. No more hard work for poor old Ned. He's gone where the good niggas go. No more hard work for poor old Ned. He's gone where the good niggas go. Such an affectionate showcase for poor old, enslaved, soon-to-be-deceased Uncle Ned was as essential as air in the white travel writer, poet, and literary critic Bayard Taylor's assessment. Included in his 1850 book, El Dorado, or Adventures in the Path of Empire. For him, minstrelsy songs and their attitudes were true expressions of the more popular side of the national character, a force that follows the American in all its emigrations, colonizations, and conquests, as certainly as the 4th of July and Thanksgiving Day. It's the rare observation that dared connect the music and its performance to the country's communal rituals. Taylor wasn't denouncing minstrelsy or slavery. He was merely predicting that the art form's impact would last as long as fireworks in Turkey. One accelerant was Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. The book's florid anti-slavery pleas jolted the nation and loaned minstrelsy a new urgency. Before the book's publication in 1852, blackface minstrels were filler between acts of a play. The average minstrel production featured a semicircle of blackface musicians that ringed an MC who oversaw the evening's action. There was no one story and no single theme. Uncle Tom's Cabin turned the variety show into its own sort of theater. Some producers made straight adaptations that transported some of the novel's most significant characters, noble enslaved Tom, angelically blonde Little Eva, Tom's evil owner Simon Legree, to the stage with little change to Stowe's fervent abolitionism. But many others couldn't tolerate Stowe. In their eyes, the book was blasphemous. They used her denunciation of slavery in Uncle Tom's Cabin to create minstrel shows that denounced her. Sure enough, among the leading men was T.D. Rice, who, it said, did a splendid blackface Tom. Minstrel productions of Stowe's book went on until the end of the Civil War in 1865, doubling as a proxy for the debates raging throughout the country about the institution of slavery itself. The Tom shows were enormously popular and so ubiquitous that they were more commonly known as UTCs. In 1862, when Abraham Lincoln reportedly, and almost certainly apocryphally, addressed Stowe as the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war, he would have been talking as much about the minstrel show as her novel. But the UTC's popularity overrode the reckoning Stowe's imperfectly righteous novel demanded. The minstrel show and its music let the audience choose when to have a heart. They could weep for overworked Uncle Ned as surely as they could ignore or even celebrate his lashed back or his body as it swung from a tree. Paradoxically, perversely, minstrelsy's grotesquerie deluded white audiences into feeling better about themselves. It induced a bearable cognitive dissonance that outlasted enslavement. The caricatures of black people as extravagantly lazy, licentious, vulgar, disheveled, and abject always drew a comforting contrast with a white person's sense of honor and civility. With a white person simply being white. No matter how bad things might be for us, at least we're not them. If blackface minstrelsy ensorcelled white America, it also saddled many a black performer with a dilemma. By the late 1860s and early 1870s, minstrelsy had become too big for any American performer to escape. In so many ways, it was the culture. If a black performer wanted to be seen or heard, chances were good that he'd have to pretend to be a white person masquerading as a black person. There was certainly no substantial paying black audiences. A black minstrel worked in front of white audiences in white concert halls on white traveling shows. He would have had no choice but to try to figure out what white audiences wanted. As long as blackface was the country's cultural juggernaut, who would pay money to see Negroes in their own skin? Before the Civil War, there were rare occasions when black artists found a way to perform as themselves. There was, for instance, Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield, an accomplished soprano who performed for all white audiences in the United States and Europe, singing the gamut from Handel to Foster. Her refulgence baffled audiences accustomed to minstrelsy's inelegance. The dexterous cornetist, fiddler, and pioneering bandleader Frank Johnson, who remains all but unknown, was one of the most acclaimed black musicians of the 19th century. He helped stage the country's first integrated concerts and in the middle of 1843, along with his all-black male troupe, endured a stoning in Allegheny City, Pennsylvania, by local white thugs. There was the fiddler Old Cornmeal, who began as a popular street vendor and wound up in 1837 as the first black man to perform as himself on a white New Orleans stage. His stuff was copied by George Nichols, a white man who took up blackface after a start in plain old clowning, and, surprise, surprise, became much more famous than the black man whose act he swiped. But For the most part, there was no reliable way in the antebellum era for black entertainers to perform on a stage without the trademark makeup. When black performers were hired, things could become complicated. Once, P.T. Barnum needed a replacement for John Diamond, his star white minstrel. In a New York City dance hall, Barnum found a boy who, it was said at the time, could outdo Diamond. And Diamond was reportedly good. The boy was genuinely black, news that would have rendered him an outrageous blight on a white consumer's narrow imagination. As Thomas Lowe Nichols would write in his 1864 compendium, 40 Years of American Life, there was not an audience in America that would not have resented in a very energetic fashion the insult of being asked to look at the dancing of a real Negro. So, Barnum greased the little nigger's face and rubbed it over with a new blacking of burned cork, painted his thick lips vermilion, put on a woolly wig over his tight curled locks, and brought him out as the champion nigger dancer of the world. This child might have been William Henry Lane, whose stage name was Master Juba. Lane was persuasive enough that Barnum could pass him off as a white person in blackface. He ceased being a real black boy in order to become Barnum's minstrel Pinocchio. And so was born the upside-down, inside-out phenomenon of black, blackface minstrelsy, in which black performers corked themselves up with a straight face or a wink, depending on the onlooker. Custom obligated them to fulfill an audience's expectations. Expectations that white performers had established. A black minstrel was impersonating the impersonation of himself. According to Henry T. Sampson's book Blacks and Blackface, there were no sets or effects, so the black blackface minstrel show was a developer of ability because the artist was placed on his own and was not aided by scenery and stage effects to get laughter. For the black blackface minstrel, mastery entailed both an awareness of a white audience's preferences and the psychological struggle to keep one's own blackness, not to mention one's own humanity, intact. A black blackface minstrel had to learn a white minstrel's routine in order to both copy and perhaps subvert it. These were unhappy innovations, and they've maintained a tight grip on American culture, on white perceptions of blackness, on the psyches of black people, whether they're on a stage or gazing up at one. The crime of blackface minstrelsy was the number it did on black people's expectations of themselves. To this day, just a whiff of minstrelsy can so disease a black person that they think they see it everywhere, in any performance. That's the psychic residue of the minstrel impersonation taking its toll, leaving you riven by distrust. You never quite know whether the blackness being presented to an audience is true or a performance. Even the most wondrous black self-expression risks contamination when white people adore it. That taint of minstrelsy dogged Louis Armstrong after the late 1940s, Nat King Cole in the 1950s, Sammy Davis Jr. from the 1950s until his death in 1990. All were deemed sellouts, Uncle Tom's minstrels. That same distrust was on full display that night in 1989 when an auditorium full of black people jeered Whitney Houston at the Soul Train Awards for essentially sounding too estranged from blackness. A ballad like Where Do Broken Hearts Go utilizes full-throated funklessness to express the blues. Haters didn't hear Houston going to church. They heard Lawrence Welk. Whitney is what the skeptics called her. Those boos at the Soul Train Awards captured exasperation with the long history of white puppetry and suspected that its strings were now pulling on her. The jeers were paranoia, expressed as disapproval. In the antebellum years, the only way for black people to perform on a stage for a white audience, as the black people they actually were, was as orators. Frederick Douglass was the most incandescent and most famed orator of that era, but his peers included, for starters, William C. Nell, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Charles Lennox Ramond, and Henry Highland Garnett, whose most famous address, often referred to as the Call to Rebellion, which he delivered at the 1843 National Colored Convention in Buffalo, urged enslaved Americans to revolt. Abolitionist barn burners tingled spines, inflamed hearts, blew minds. Oration served as absolute anti-minstrelsy. Black people summoning galvanic vocal performances in their own skin for a cause. Here was a righteous alternative to the insults of blackface. Here was another altogether more aspirational standard of black expression. It was moral. It was holy. It was artful. Mellifluous speeches with suspense, structure, repetition, and judgment delivered to white people and free black people in meeting houses and enslaved black people in their places of worship. Black orators rejected whatever it was that minstrelsy had convinced the country black people were. And they did so within institutions that were black built and black maintained. They often strove for betterment, for progress, for uplift, for respect, praising God for helping lead the people out of the valley toward the freedom that drove all that oration in the first place. Comportment was important, from the age of the colored conventions to the civil rights era. That quest for respectability was actually a battle for rights. And in the 1960s, the battle was being broadcast into American homes, white American homes. It made all the sense in the world that holy men and women did the leading, that the movement's greatest musical avatars were the gospel star Mahalia Jackson and Marian Anderson, an artistic descendant of Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield and the country's preeminent black opera singer at the time. But so much classiness, churchiness, and rhetorical brilliance, whether it belonged to Frances Ellen Watkins Harper or Martin Luther King Jr., also made certain black people nervous about performances of self-expression beyond the church. Anytime a black gospel star, Sam Cooke say, or Aretha Franklin, went pop, black congregants suspected that a white producer had gotten his wings. Going pop represented one perceived transgression of the idealized embodiment of blackness offered by reverends and preachers and politicians. In and of itself, a movement demands respectability. The demand for equality necessitates the appearance of seeming equal, and therefore worthy of respect. This, in part, is how a century's worth of gains were achieved, through the refulgent, relentless, strategic display of worthiness. But there's respectability that empowers and respectability that imprisons. And the imprisoning sort remains a bane for Black America. Its people were fully aware of the abysmal expectations minstrelsy had established, a roulette of contempt, shame, rage, self-consciousness, appeasement. The art form's racism has proved poisonous to a racist's collective self-esteem. A 19th century full of white people's artistic mockery buried landmines that lasted well into the 20th century. Does every black performer who seems to evoke minstrelsy warrant comparison to a minstrel? Is there any way for a black performer to achieve national acclaim in a country with a majority white population without incurring charges of selling out? How deeply do those accusations stain, haunt, stifle the accused? Everybody from the blackface comedian Burt Williams and the dancer Bill Bojangles Robinson to the rappers Flava Flav and Kanye West to O.J. Simpson during his spokesman stints and acting days to the entertainer Wayne Brady to Clarence Thomas, Alan Keyes, Herman Cain in political spheres, to rock-oriented musicians like Tina Turner and Lenny Kravitz, to Diana Ross and Oprah Winfrey. They've all bestirred worry and provoked embarrassment among black folks. Is their blackness an act? Is the act under white control? Is their blackness detectable or sufficiently, what, soulful? The most respectable acts, even when they were black performers on a black label, could find themselves accused of minstrelsy. Yes, for some black people, even Berry Gordy's piloting all those flights to the top of Billboard's Hot 100 singles chart seemed like traveling too close to the sun. Under Mr. Gordy's strict hands-on direction, James Brown wrote in his autobiography, the Motown show and catalog were shaped around pop, and their acts were made to strut like minstrels. That accursed art form is still misshaping perceptions so that not every victory gets to feel like a win. Motown wanted, in its way, to obliterate this neurotic prison, to adjust the scope of the black self-image. The company's pageant of coordinated crispness was as resolutely anti-minstrelsy as the tradition of black oratory. White people were forced to behold men and women looking as divine as they sounded. The music captured Black America's hearts and opened white America's minds, at the precise moment when that openness seemed vital for the country's very sanity. Today, what Gordy pulled off tends to be reclassified as stodgy or uncool. Closer to Brown's assessment that it's not simply evoking an ugly past, but exploiting it. Not an unreasonable conclusion in the 21st century. During the reign of Drake and Megan Thee Stallion, of a dozen different Lils, yet Motown remains an unmovable landmark. This, the company has proven, is how things should have been all along, with black people captaining their artistic and commercial destinies. Singing music they composed, cashing checks their music brought in. Their songs understood and appreciated, just as Gordy had dreamt, the sound of America. This country clings to its institutional orthodoxies about what exactly American means when it comes to black musicians. All seems well. Black artists continue to be widely listened to and lauded and imitated. Yet, trouble simmers below the surface. We've been rid of blackface minstrelsy for more than a century. Well, we've had much less of it, let's put it that way. But its tastes and insinuations, its gamesmanship and manipulations are still with us, coursing through institutions, still threatening to bring the house down, still stuffing black artists in black boxes. The dominance Gordy carved out, for instance, is what an artist like Tyler, the Creator, wished for himself when he took a moment to ruminate after winning a Grammy in one of the rap categories in 2020. "I'm just like, why can't we be in pop?" he said backstage. "Half of me feels like the rap nomination was just a backhanded compliment." The following year, Beyoncé became the woman with the most Grammys, 28. The majority of her wins, however, were in a rap or R&B category, and only one was for song, record, or album of the year. Maybe this would matter less if rap and R&B were marginal elements of the American sound. Instead, they're the music those elite pop Grammys wind up honoring. It's just that, of late, the recipients of that industrial hardware have tended to be other than black. In 2017, the Recording Academy that awards the statues handed Album of the Year to Adele, a white Brit who practices a polished kind of adult contemporary soul music. And the following year, the award went to Bruno Mars, an American of Filipino and Puerto Rican descent, whose project partially entails simply dousing funk and R&B with expensive-sounding nostalgia. It's been almost 200 years since T.D. Rice jumped Jim Crow, but minstrelsy's priorities remain the country's preference. Americans have made a political investment in a myth of racial separateness, the idea that art forms can be either white or black in character, when aspects of many are at least both. Our original art form arose from our original sin, and some white people have always worried that the primacy of black music would be a kind of karmic punishment for that sin. Umbrage is what fueled the explosion in 2019 of Old Town Road, a remixed duet between a newbie from Atlanta who goes by Lil Nas X and the former honky-tonk heartthrob Billy Ray Cyrus. The song wedded trap music to country, a mashup the world received as novel when really it was a return to everybody's roots. One reason the black band leader Frank Johnson isn't better known might be that the styles of music he perfected seem awfully close to what you might hear at a square dance or a hoedown, music that would come to seem synonymous with white culture. Synonymous enough that in the 1920s, during jazz's ascent, Henry Ford urged Americans to rally around the purported whiteness of the square dance. Enough that more than 200 years after Johnson's birth, we're only lately raising a critical eyebrow at country music's assertion of white purity. It's true that the proliferation of black culture across the planet, the proliferation in so many senses of being black, constitutes a magnificent joke on American racism. Yet, that popularity hasn't strayed far from that covetous encounter between T.D. Rice and the black man he watched groom that horse. Something about white America's desire for blackness warps and perverts its source, lampoons and cheapens it even in adoration. Loving black culture has never demanded a corresponding love of black people. And loving black culture has tended to result in loving the life out of it. But not always. The ongoing disputes over whose stuff is whose obscures a more important irony. Music has midwifed the only true integration this country has known. Minstrelsy's non-consensual impersonations hog the headlines because it was the start of American popular culture as we still know it. But the history of American music also effervesces with work made by white people alongside black people. It's rich with white artists who worked in black traditions with admiration and respect, and features the occasional black artist who, understanding the preference in certain corners of the marketplace for sanitized editions of their songs, counted the money as white artists rode black music up the charts. Bobby and Shirley Womack's It's All Over Now wasn't a big hit until the Rolling Stones made it one in 1964. Womack complained until he got his first royalty check. Different generations of jazz artists have insisted that race doesn't matter, that the music doesn't care what color you are. That's an American romance. But in jazz, it's sometimes a kind of truth in action, provable by the hazards certain acts like Dave Brubeck's quartet endure to play and stay integrated. The record producer and concert promoter Norman Granz worked with integrated bands, insisted on equal pay, and would sooner cancel a show than have his artists play for segregated houses. And the risk has often sounded worth it. The historian Anne Douglas writes in Terrible Honesty, her history of popular culture in the 1920s, that American entertainment, whatever the state of American society, has always been integrated, if only by theft and parody. What we've been dealing with ever since is more than a catch-all word like appropriation can approximate. The truth is more bounteous and more spiritual than that, more confused. That confusion resides in the notorious tales of Michael Jackson taking from James Brown and Sammy Davis Jr. over here, and Fred Astaire and Freddie Mercury over there, in the arena-ready rock and roll feel that Run-DMC and their producer Rick Rubin arrived at together. It's there in the wink-wink costume funk of Beck's 1999 Midnight Vultures, an album whose kicky nonsense circles back to the popular culture of 150 years earlier. It's in the melismatic hair flips of Ariana Grande. It's in what we once called blue-eyed soul, though I've never known what to do with that term, which euphemistically, almost jokingly labels even its most convincing practitioners, the Bee Gees, Michael McDonald, Bobby Caldwell, Hall & Oates, Tina Marie, Annie Lennox, Simply Red, George Michael, Taylor Dane, Lisa Stansfield, Josh Stone, Robin Thicke, as diet black music. The term might be out to mock or judge or offset, but it points to a crucial distinction between what's appreciative and what's appropriative. Flaws and all, these are non-black artists committed to black music, often working alongside black musicians, which is to say with black musicians' consent. That kind of collaboration can't change what took place a century or two before. It can't change the sins of the 20th century. It remains outrageously true, for instance, that once black musicians like Howlin' Wolf, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and Ike and Tina Turner built rock and roll, white kids pounced and gentrified. Hip-hop and R&B have proved harder to colonize. This music remains at the creative and commercial center of American popular music, a fact that might further underscore how superfluous black people can seem in everybody's attempt at blackness. Yet hip-hop's rapid adaptability also proves how little territory black people are willing to cede, how they continue to expand the landscape, how there has always been something in black music that's viscerally attractive yet distinctively elusive. A depth of feeling that the field songs and spirituals instilled, perhaps eternally. The undying attraction to that feeling also gets at something thrillingly crucial about the music and its people. What so much of the sound is staked upon. Humanity. It also gets at what's remained elusive to certain white interlopers. Black music brims with call and response, layers of syncopation, and this rougher element called noise, derived from unique sounds that arise from the particular hue and timbre of an instrument. Little Richard's woos and knuckled keyboard zooms, the breathless flutter of Charlie Parker's saxophone, Patti LaBelle's emotional police siren, DMX's scorched earth bark, the misty wonder of Alberta Hunter and the wondrous hurt of Billie Holiday, the visceral stank of Etta James. the landmine phrasing of Aretha Franklin, the pulpit ferocity of live in concert Whitney Houston, Prince committing arson with an electric guitar. What you're hearing in what we call black music is a miracle of sound, an experience that, like the spirituals, can really happen only off the page. Not just melisma or glissandi, the rasp of a sax, breakbeats or sampling, but the mood or inspiration from which those moments arise. Writing down the asides and ad-libs and overdubs and yelps and wails, the extended solos, the mumbled running together of rhymes, seems, if you think about it, like a fool's errand. The flowers wilting under hot water that Zora Neale Hurston was talking about. It's not that black music isn't written, it certainly is, but so much of its glory can't be captured in recorded notes alone. That results from spontaneity. It resides between the notes, in personalities, in grunts, sighs, gestures, timbre, inflections, phrasing. You wouldn't be trying to capture the arrangement of notes per se. You'd be trying to capture the uncatchable, the spirit. And that's because what is original to black American music is a mode by which singers and musicians could be completely free. Free in the only way that would have been possible under enslavement, through art, through music. It was music no one composed, in part because enslaved people were denied literacy. Music born of feeling, of play, of exhaustion, of uncertainty, of anguish, of existential introspection. It was music whose depth could elude its own makers. Frederick Douglass writes in one of his personal histories, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, about listening to the singing of the enslaved. They would sometimes sing the most pathetic sentiment in the most rapturous tone, and the most rapturous sentiment in the most pathetic tone. Especially would they do this when leaving home. They would then sing most exultingly the following words. I am going away to the great house farm. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh. This they would sing as a chorus to words which to many would seem unmeaning jargon, but which nevertheless were full of meaning to themselves. I have sometimes thought that the mere hearing of those songs would do more to impress some minds with the horrible character of slavery than the reading of whole volumes of philosophy on the subject could do. Douglass understood their singing as a testament to a particular kind of pain, and to a unique form of perseverance and self-inquiry. Why us? And how much longer? And what more? But also, with respect to both physical and spiritual deliverance, when? The music testifies to a perilous condition as much as it offers hope that somehow it will end. This is to say that when we're talking about black music, we're talking about what the borrowers and collaborators don't want to or simply can't lift. Centuries of weight, of atrocity we've never sufficiently worked through. The treasure you know is beyond theft because it's too real, too rich, too heavy to steal. Doesn't the temptation to take from blackness make sense then? Here is the music of a people who have survived, who not only won't stop, but also can't be stopped. Music by a people whose major innovations, jazz, rock and roll, funk, hip-hop, have been about progress, about the future, about getting as far away from nostalgia as time will allow. Music that's thought deeply about the allure of outer space and robotics. Music whose promise and possibility, whose rawness, humor, and carnality call out to everybody. To other black people, to kids in working class England, middle class Indonesia, and the cités of Paris. To teenagers in Seoul, Mexico City, and Bogota. If freedom's ringing, who on earth wouldn't want to rock that bell?